Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by Samantha Schreiber, and a little later we're going to have Tyrone Carter, state representative, talking to us about law enforcement, the shooting in Grand Rapids, and the House Republicans' plans on what to do with stimulus dollars and the surplus and all the money they're going to soak into law enforcement. And then Bill Ballinger is going to be joining us, Samantha. We're going to talk a little gubernatorial politics, talk a little history, and all the people who are going to file there. But first, joining us here in MERS World Headquarters is Scott Hagerstrom. He is what he calls a disruptor for Rogue Strategy Group, and communications strategist Caitlin Buss. And we are talking Republican Party Convention this weekend. And you know what? I just got something slipped to me. Did you guys know that Donald Trump is going to be in Ohio on Saturday?
Yes.
You did know that. Okay. Well, why doesn't that surprise me, Scott? What do you think the chances are that the Trumpster comes and slides by GR?
That's a good question.
Wouldn't that be fun, though, if he did?
I think you never know in Trump world what's going to happen or what he's going to say or what he's going to do. So it wouldn't surprise me because he's all in for DiPerno.
That's right.
I feel like there would be too many logistics for that, though, if no one had seen it coming already. But I can definitely imagine that there could be like a Zoom call, a FaceTime, a little bit of a Trump presentation of sorts.
Maybe a video or
the
something.
Middle ground. Yeah.
Yeah, it could be a video. All right, so we've got on the agenda for this Republican endorsement convention, first time that we've done this as far as the Republican Party is concerned, they are going to have their endorsements for basically the entire ticket outside of the governor, attorney general, secretary of state, Supreme Court, and then the education boards in Grand Rapids. So it could be a very long day. And I think we all know the dynamics at play here, where we have Donald Trump, former president, has two preferred candidates for attorney general and secretary of state. Michon Maddock, who's the co-chair of the Republican Party, is kind of the field general to try and push these two over the edge. They've recruited the services of John Yob from Strategic National, who knows quite a bit about conventions, who has had a very successful track record in getting these candidates who he is, whose clients he's working for, getting them through the convention and having them on the ballot. So against this backdrop, we have competitive elections. Caitlin Buss, I want to ask you, what are you going to be looking for, and will you be surprised if the Trump-endorsed candidates are not successful?
I will not be surprised if they're not successful. My hope is that the convention is as drama-free as possible. But, I think what we're in for is a potential surprise.
Really?
I do. I could see it based on how the conventions have gone, you know, this past week, based on the groundswell here and just some of the feedback and John Yob's own words. I mean, I think there's a surprise to be had. I don't think ultimately they'll pull it out, but I do think there'll be some floor drama and some last minute attempts to really get him past the line.
Now, Scott, you did Trump's work in 2016. You were his point person here in Michigan in 2016. Would you be surprised if the Trump-backed candidates were not successful?
I think Christina's pretty much a shoe-in. It's been a much smoother ride for her.
Christina Cromo for Secretary of State.
Yes. DiPerno on Attorney General. I feel the momentum is with his campaign at this point. I was really surprised by Tom Leonard only attending Clinton County and Eaton County conventions in not Kent County, not Metro Detroit. I just feel the energy is with DiPerno. I wouldn't be surprised if the last minute celebrity showing up in support of DiPerno, whether it be Trump Jr., Eric, or maybe some other famous person in Trump world to sort of help push him over the top. But what I really, this is an endorsement convention. So if DiPerno was not to win, I wouldn't be surprised if the fight is continued until August, when there's new delegates elected on August 2nd.
So the campaign doesn't die. Do you agree with that, Caitlin?
I certainly don't. I agree. I think the fight will continue if he does not win. And that'll be unfortunate for the entire Republican Party. But yeah, I think that's right. I don't think that those sentiments are going anywhere.
I agree. It would be unfortunate.
So what about Tom Leonard, though? If he is not successful, does he try and push this into the nominating convention in August?
I've been a little surprised at his gloves. You know, I think he could have been a little bit more aggressive throughout this campaign. I think he's relied a little bit, you know, too much on kind of the establishment backing, the funding, and kind of the narrative that he is, you know, the most reasonable choice. So I would like to see a little more aggression from him in fighting this out.
I don't know. What do you think, Scott? Do you think he just picks up his ball and goes home if he loses?
Yeah, I think if he loses, he's done for the year.
Because if the person who does not get the endorsement, they have very long odds going into the nominating convention, because you need over 75% of the delegates in the nominating convention in August to overturn the endorsement convention. That's big. How do you do that, Scott?
With a lot of money and a lot of star power. You know, we don't have the deadline for delegates until May 3rd, and Trump doesn't take very lightly losing, and we'll continue to fight, and I see DiPerno doing the same thing I see in this campaign, storm the convention. But I think at the end of the day, you know, if it's close, that will give them more energy and impetus to move forward to the August convention. So we'll just have to wait and see. I think DiPerno at the end of the day will come out on top. I have not endorsed, and I'm not involved in that race whatsoever, so I'm just going to be watching it for entertainment value.
Speaking of entertainment, a quick disclaimer. I was the MERS reporter at the Macomb County GOP convention, and a lot of reporters have kind of shared the sentiment that it was probably one of the most exciting events to cover of the year. There's only 288 delegates for that Macomb County GOP convention, but then there was close to 700 people who attended. That's a massive difference between guest and delegate ratio, and I'm kind of anticipating a similar thing to occur at this convention, that there's going to be a lot of individuals from all areas of Michigan wanting to try to make their voice heard. I'm a sucker for a good underdog candidate. I really like Ryan Berman's candidacy when I was covering the Macomb County Convention, and there's just kind of an area where it's a lot of guests figuring out where exactly they should go because they were removed out of the room for the GOP chair vote. And then, you know, Ryan Berman had staffers and interns that were like, oh, by the way, Ryan Berman's really cool. We have really cool merch, really cool values, etc. So I think there are a few people that have been kind of people who were DiPerno is a little too much for them, especially in the aftermath of that Bridge article about some of the allegations made against him from his own law firm that he used to work at. I wouldn't be surprised if the numbers for Berman are a little bit surprising as well.
Yeah, and I think you're, and I don't want to shift the conversation too much, but pointing to the fact that people are really interested in this process, right? And given the political atmosphere that we've had for the past few years, people want to know how the sausage is made. And whether that's good or bad or the merits of that, there is a lot of interest. And the primary process and these delegate processes, this is where the political process begins, and people are paying more attention to that.
I'll be honest, I had no idea what a delegate was when I was in high school and college. I never had that, you know, taught to me. So it's kind of like I got my journalism.
I don't think you're alone in that.
It's like I got my journalism job, and I was thinking like, oh yeah, so like AG, that's on like the ballot, right, in August. And everyone's like, no, there's a whole convention process that I had no idea about.
The endorsement convention, this is brand new, and so for our listeners who might not be familiar with this, so there's an endorsement convention which the Republican Party is doing for the first time, so that it kind of sets up their Attorney General, Secretary of State nominee to be more successful come the general election, so they can raise better money, they can raise more money, they can get more visibility, and so on. Scott, do you think this is a good idea? They took this off the Democrats' playbook, who started this back in 2010. They seem to like it. They think it's a good idea. What do you think?
Yeah, I think it's really hard when you're running a primary and you put everything you can into it and you wake up on August 3rd and your bank account's at zero and you have to turn around and run a general election in just a very short amount of time. So I think generally for the party, it's a good idea because it gives the candidates that receive the endorsement more runway to actually focus on defeating the incumbent Democrats that are very partisan. But, you know, back to the point earlier, oftentimes the skill set to win election are very different than the skill set needed to be successful in office. So when you talk about Ryan Berman and Tom Leonard, you know, I've talked to delegates and they see that and they are paying attention. Now, usually it gets swept up in the momentum of the moment, and sometimes that gets lost. You know, who's actually the most qualified to hold the office and be successful? But on the other hand, we have to take out a very successful and very hardworking incumbent in Dana Nessel, which I actually have personal feelings of hoping that she loses.
She didn't come after you with a lawsuit or anything, did she?
She's trying to get me disbarred, that's all.
Yeah, no big
just
deal.
Asking a few questions, and she's trying to disbar me.
Well, and she would argue that it was there was some basis to that, but I didn't want to talk about that. I want to get back to a comment you made, Caitlin, about Secretary of State. You said that you see Christina Caramo being successful. What could have... First of all, Bo LaFave is also running. Cindy Berry, clerk over in Macomb County, who is a township clerk over there. Did they just get in too late? How did Christina Caramo get into this position where she is seen as the prohibitive frontrunner?
Well, I think she has a lot to bring to the table, right? As a candidate, she she represents a lot of where I think Republicans want to be, and so she's a very respectable voice in that way. I think the sad thing here is that the office she's running for is not really suited to maybe some of the themes that she's talking about. I mean, when you're talking about Secretary of State, people are really looking for competency and service, and that's a very public-facing job. And you have her out there talking about, election narratives and, just issues that aren't necessarily related to what that position would be. And for most independents, I think that's a frustrating place to be. I think we need to get back to talking about the job and not talking about the extreme narratives, surrounding the political atmosphere. I mean, that's what I think voters would be looking for in a Secretary of State.
Now, here's my question. So, Representative LaFave, he's kind of taken, he's nicknamed her QAnon Caramo, and is posting all this stuff like, look, she attended this event in Las Vegas. QAnon was there, like hardcore conspiracy theories, like in that deep, deep hole. Is that something that will, is it helpful for Representative LaFave at all to be utilizing this as a tactic?
I don't think that it's helpful at all. I think guilt by association doesn't work just because two individuals and a group happen to be at the same event doesn't mean that she buys into their sort of whole narrative, the QAnon narrative. But I do agree that this is very much a process-driven position, someone that needs to be very organized. It's not a Secretary of State isn't so much a policy position, by Christina talking policy, that really isn't her job when she becomes Secretary of State. Although we've seen Jocelyn Benson rebuked by the courts when she sent out absentee applications to every voter that was later termed illegal. Mm-hmm. I guess she won't get disbarred for that, though.
No, and Caramo's, not wildly out of her lane to talk about election integrity and stuff like that. But I think to focus back on Michigan voters and what they're looking for in a Secretary of State would be the best approach for any of those people instead of getting, caught up in the narratives.
Well, and I mentioned Bo LaFave and Cindy Berry. Did they get in too late? Because it seemed like Christina Caramo was the only Secretary of State candidate for the summer of 2021. Bo LaFave and Cindy Berry didn't get in until the Republican convention up in Mackinac, or not convention, the conference up on Mackinac Island in late September. And by then, Caramo had the stage to herself for months, Scott.
I think it's more they lack excitement. It's not that they're not nice people or maybe have good ideas to bring to the table. Christina Caramo is an exciting candidate. She's a good speaker. She doesn't have some of the baggage that DiPerno's perceived to have, his representation to some controversial lawmakers in the past. And so I think, her speaking skills, her personality, she brings a bit of excitement, a bit of entertainment. Bo LaFave and Cindy Berry they don't sort of have, I guess, what you'd call that it factor. Mm-hmm. So perhaps if there was more of a mainstream candidate, I know people like Kim Meltzer were looking at it, a former elected official, current clerk, that maybe have a little more pizzazz.
Ann Boland, maybe?
Maybe Ann Boland, yes.
Yeah, it's possible. You heard Christina Caramo speak. at the Trump event. Well, Samantha, you did.
Yeah.
There was a lot of excitement for that, wasn't there?
I mean, I make this observation at any event that I go to, but I would say that she was easily the best speaker at that event on the lineup. I think she had a very intense energy that was very contagious. People were chanting out, Christina, Christina, like a lot of people that are just extremely in love with her as a candidate. And I really didn't see that with much of the other kind of state level candidates that were present at the event.
Scott, there are other positions that are going to be up at this convention. Supreme Court is pretty much set, isn't it? Brian Zara, and we've got a new attorney who's in the mix as well.
Yeah, I think that's pretty set. I think you're going to see some battles at the Education Board, State Education Board, Michigan State Board of Trustees, and University of Michigan Regents. But compared to the big race is going to be Attorney General.
Yeah.
I think that's what everyone sees is all the energy is going to. But, you know, there's 1 week left. We'll see if any of these others get interesting.
All right. So how long will this go? So if this is in Grand Rapids, if we have multiple ballots, what are the chances, Caitlin, where we have questions about the tallying of the votes and controversy about counting of ballots?
I think that's a given, but to their credit, they've tried to get ahead of that and come up with some ground rules that will make their audience happy. But I think there's some of that to be expected and moving forward through these elections.
Do you know how they're supposed to be doing this, Scott?
My understanding is they're using ballot machines, and there's already a group out there that's been laying the groundwork to say that that those can be tainted or demanding a hand vote.
Yeah, they're doing a hand vote.
And so I think there is a backup hand
vote.
Yeah,
a backup hand
but
audit.
Probably with the more louder elements of the party, if it doesn't turn out the way they want it to, I expect to hear screams of, there's fraud, the cheating.
It's not one person, one vote, is it? I mean, it's proportional based on, I know that's how they did it on the Democratic side, that it's proportional based on congressional districts. So if only some of your people showed up and not all of them, some of those votes might be worth more than a district where you had just a flood of people and everybody voted.
I think it's proportional to 2020, is it?
Yeah, there's some proportion. You're correct. So say in the 14th congressional district, there's supposed to be 8%, but only 6% of the delegates show up. They may get a couple extra votes that will be allotted based on how the people present vote. Right. So there's a little bit of that, but can make a difference in a very close race. But if it's sort of a blowout or not close, it's that should not make a difference.
And we should tell our listeners as well that it's not plurality wins, it's majority that wins. So if on the first ballot, DiPerno gets 40% and Tom Leonard gets 40% and Ryan Berman gets 20%, it's a second ballot, not because those numbers aren't good examples because they are tied, but in general, you got to get 50 plus one, right, Scott?
That is correct.
So if you don't win on the first, you go to a second ballot. Would it be a loss for Trump if DiPerno doesn't win on the first ballot?
At the end of the day, I don't think so. If he, at the end of the day, wins, then it's a win for Trump. I think that will get lost. People like us may make a big deal of it, but the narrative nationwide or in the state news is going to be Trump's person won.
Do you agree with that, Caitlin?
I think it'll be really hard if he wins for Michigan Republicans to move forward. I think that's going to be a big challenge. But it will be a very big national story if he wins, regardless of how the details are there.
So we did some polling on this very issue, and we talked about this in a few podcasts prior about Matt DiPerno versus Tom Leonard against Dana Nessel. And from what we saw, and that obviously this is very early in the process, there was about a 3 or 4 percentage point difference. Tom Leonard did 3 or 4 percentage points better than Matt DiPerno. How much harder do you think it's going to be for Matt DiPerno and Christina Caramo in November, given that they can be tied to Trump and conspiracy and 2020 election fraud, not being able to get off that subject?
I think they have a real challenge ahead. I think people are going to get sick of the Trump relitigation. I do think that. At the same time, I think to disregard the sentiments that ultimately led to Trump and all of that we've gone through would be foolish. So I think that, you know, DiPerno or Leonard versus Nessel is a decent race. But yeah, I think we see where this goes. The Trump factor is not going away, but I do think some of that support is going to keep falling off throughout the summer. People are going to be reinvigorated about issues closer to home, issues that they're really worried about.
This is supposed to be a Republican year, Scott. And I don't know if you saw this, but Samantha did a story, what was it, last week?
Yes. So I did a story on Friday that said, are we talking about the gubernatorial race right now?
No, about the candidates, when we counted off the candidates. Oh, that was Andrew who did that.
Yeah.
All right. So what we did is we counted how many legislative candidates on the Republican and Democratic side there has been in the last 20 years. And what we saw was that the only time the Republicans had more candidates than Democrats was 2010. And in that year, of course, Republicans just wiped everyone out. And then in 2014, it was very close. Again, a very good Republican year. All the Republicans won re-election, and Republicans won the House and the Senate again and whatever. But when the gap was really wide, Democrats like had a ton more candidates, like 100 more candidates than the Republicans. 2008, Democrats took charge of everything. So there seems to be a correlation between the number of candidates and how that party does. So we're going into 2022, and the Republicans have about 50 more candidates than Democrats right now for the state legislature. I say that because this should be a Republican year. And so, Scott, that's why I'm asking you, does it matter if it's Matt DiPerno and Tom Leonard, if the signs are pointing to a Republican blowout in November?
At the end of the day, it may not matter because, you know, a lot of this is inside baseball that we talk about. We talk about the 2020 election. They're focused too much on that. But we see Democrat vote is going to be depressed. They're not going to get out in the numbers they have in the past. We've seen that in wave years. People are concerned about inflation, gas prices, putting food on the table, the budget, and they see the advantage Granholm had in 2006 against DeVos is she could just blame Bush. Whitmer cannot. It's a president of her own party, Biden, so she's tied to that, and all the Democrats here are tied to the national administration. So I think it's going to be bread and butter issues, but there's always a caveat. We see what just happened in Grand Rapids with the shooting. Things like that can come up. Issues can come up. You know, I was a little worried. You know, we see the war in Ukraine and thought, okay, there's an opportunity for Biden to look like a commander in chief and sort of rally the nation behind him. That has not benefited him to this point. But just like the shooting in Grand Rapids, other issues could come up between now and November and derail this big Republican wave. But at the end of the day, it's going to be about budget issues. Pelosi and the Dems are going to do everything they can to focus on January 6th committee, the last election, and use that to probably try to motivate their base to get out. But they have a very tall hill to climb.
Well, I think enthusiasm really does have a driving force in elections. And I want to think about the different, the endorsement convention on the Democratic side that was in Detroit the other weekend, is that they had more than 50% of their delegates attending virtually. There just really wasn't a lot of people there, a ton of empty chairs. All of the caucuses were meeting virtually. And I know we talked to Dennis Steno about it, and he essentially said, you know, there's no reason to go there unless you wanted to meet a candidate or see your friends. You know, these were incumbent candidates. But here for Grand Rapids, there's probably going to be people camping out for this event. What do you kind of think about that? Do they just look like they have very low enthusiasm right now?
I think what, you know, there's enthusiasm at this point in the process because they're fighting for control of their party. I think once you get through this, some of that will fall off because some people aren't going to be happy. So one way or another, that enthusiasm is going to die down a little bit. I also think, you know, to the broader point, this is Republicans' year to lose. Historically, they've been doing a lot of things that are self-inflicted wounds to kind of make that, you know, victory could be gone from them because of that. And at the same time, like Scott was saying, you know, there are still plays out there. Whitmer has done her abortion play, and I think that's going to some extent motivate some of those younger Democrat-leaning women who've kind of fallen off, you know, in what's going on now. It might get them back. So there are a couple wild cards still out there, even though it does seem like issue-wise and sentiment-wise, Republicans are you know, it's theirs to lose.
All right. Well, that's going to do it. We've run out of time here, but Caitlin Buss, appreciate you coming in, and yeah, Scott Hagerstrom as well. Good to see you again. And we're going to close the book on this end, and we're going to be joined by Bill Ballinger in just a minute.
Thanks. And a message coming from my eyes says, leave it
alone. Join us now on the podcast is our friend Bill Ballinger from the Ballinger Report. Thanks for joining us, Bill.
My pleasure, Kyle.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the Republican field for governor right now, because this is developing into something pretty crazy. Samantha counted yesterday that we have six candidates. We're going to have seven. And then presuming Tudor Dixon and Kevin Rinke and Perry Johnson all send in their signatures, we're looking at 10 Republican candidates, the most since 1920. I wanted to get your thoughts on this, Bill.
It's unprecedented, no question about it. I mean, the nine candidate field 1920, I believe, was an all-time record. I don't think if you go back in the 19th century, you're going to find that many. And since 1920, this is way beyond that. We had seven Democrats run back in 1982, but that's when it was an open seat. Governor Milliken was not running again. And a lot of Democrats had been frozen out of the governor's office for 20 years, and they were revving to go, and it was a bad economy, and in the middle of Ronald Reagan's first term, and they were excited, and they filed, and that was it. This looks like it'll break that record.
So who is the kind of a leader? When you've got that many candidates, how do you kind of handicap that from kind of a political prognostication standpoint?
Another strange thing about this year's race is you have one candidate who got out of the gates quickly back last summer, and that's James Craig, the former Detroit police chief, who had a lot of push from major power brokers in the Republican Party, and he also had a lot of name ID down in the Metro Detroit area. So that was literally 10 months ago. And he's been coasting on that early start, where all the polls taken since then have showed him way ahead of everybody else in the field. But then at the end of last year and early this year, two multimillionaires, Kevin Rinke and Perry Johnson, got in the race. They both started running TV ads. Johnson seemingly has broken through, at least in terms of name ID. So the most recent poll shows him moving up into a quasi-respectable second place behind Craig. And Rinke is still trailing back in single digits. So going forward, we've still got a long way. We got 3.5 months until the August 2nd primary. And Craig has had trouble raising money. He's not going to be able to keep up with either Perry Johnson or Kevin Rinke. Tudor Dixon, another candidate who has a lot of support among party leaders, but has been really unable to raise money and has spent almost as much as she's raised, so she's got very little cash on hand. There's a PAC out there of about $1 million that's ready to support her, but that's not going to be enough for her, just the money, I don't think. To really be able to compete with Craig, Johnson, and Rinke. So that's the way it looks right now. But the amazing thing is there are all these other candidates who have filed or may still file who are staying in the race. They're not being scared away. Now, they're going to come in trailing way back on August 2nd. In my estimation, they're going to be in low single digits. But that hasn't deterred them from staying on the ballot.
So, and this is one of my questions then. So what you're saying is this becomes a name ID and money game. When you have this many candidates, it's all about trying to get your name out there so that when people go to this bedsheet ballot and they see 10 names, they're going to pick your name.
That's correct. And there's one thing, of course, we haven't mentioned, and that is Donald Trump. Can we go through any Republican race anywhere in the country this year without mentioning Trump? Who is going to get his endorsement if he makes one? He has not made one. And there's a lot of speculation right now that the fix may be in because Perry Johnson has his campaign being run by John Yob. And John Yob is supporting Matt DiPerno, a candidate for attorney general, in the state convention endorsing for Republicans on April 23rd in Grand Rapids. Now, if DiPerno is able to win that endorsement backed by Yob, Trump will be very pleased to see that his candidate for attorney general has won the endorsement, and also maybe Christina Caramo for secretary of state endorsed by Trump. And so the speculation is that shortly thereafter, Donald Trump will come in behind Perry Johnson and endorse him. So if people are confronted with 10 candidates on August 2nd, and one of them has at least as high name ID as Perry Johnson does, maybe equal to James Craig at that point, and he's got the Trump endorsement, and 80% of Republican primary voters are more inclined to support somebody who's endorsed by Trump, I think that gives Perry Johnson a leg up on everybody. But again, we got 3.5 months to go, and a lot can happen.
So I just want to reiterate that Michigan had its first ever gubernatorial primary elections in 1910. So if there is 10 candidates on this GOP ballot, that would be the largest primary ballot in 112 years. I just want that to sink in for everyone before I continue what I have to say. But I think with a 10-candidate arena, and that's saying that, you know, Tudor Dixon, Kevin Rinke, Perry Johnson, and of course, James Craig is turning in his signatures today, are all on it. I think it really showcases the different fractions that have been created within the Republican Party in this Donald Trump era. You have the anti-establishment fraction. You have people that are very dead set on a forensic audit. And I know that we've talked both in our articles and on this podcast about the true value of a Trump endorsement and how it could help you be extraordinarily successful in a primary election, but could also be your greatest weakness in a general election. Now, when you think about the MAGA grassroots crowd, the bread and butter of Donald Trump and the MAGA name, these are people that have kind of already found their candidate. These are people that are big fans of Garrett Saldano, big fans of Ryan Kelly, big fans of Ralph Rebrandt, people that have been showing up to the events and promoting this Trump rhetoric from 2020. And it makes me think, when we get to August, is it going to be the more moderate Republicans, more of those red-leaning independents who show up to vote in August that are going to determine this election? Because that very heavy MAGA demographic seems to already be divided right now.
And I think that is Garrett Saldano's, what he didn't want to have happen. I don't know if you remember this, Samantha, but early in this campaign, Austin Chang, who was the first Republican candidate who got into the race, wanted to, and he actually signed a pact with Garrett Saldano, Ryan Kelly, Ralph Rebrandt, Bob Scott, who's also a candidate in the race, and Tudor Dixon, I think, actually signed this too, that they signed a pact that they would not all run against each other, that they would endorse one of them to go up and go forward against what they thought was going to be the establishment candidate in James Craig. But instead, what happened is Austin Chang is the only one who dropped out. And so now we have all these other candidates who are gathering the support of what you're talking about, kind of this MAGA movement and kind of the right-wing, almost conspiratorial crowd. And now it's divided up Saldano's potential support in totally different directions. You got Donna Brandenburg now. You got Ryan Kelly now. I mean, the support is now, I think, diluted. And he's almost kind of hit a wall almost. He has hit 10%. And unless he expands his outreach and tries to appeal to kind of a more broader population, I don't know how he goes forward. I don't know how he gets
beyond 10 and maybe 15%. And I don't think you could win this race with 10 or 15%. I think his star has gone down unless he does something different to broaden himself out there. And I think claiming Gretchen Whitmer working with the FBI in some kind of conspiratorial plot, that's not going to do it.
You know, and let's say that Donald Trump, we don't know that he's going to immediately give someone an endorsement after the April 23rd endorsement convention. We don't really know what's going to happen because it hasn't happened yet. You know, Trump says vote for the American First Patriot candidate. There's already five American First Patriot candidates on the ballot.
Right. Exactly. Exactly. Bill, what do you think about all this?
I would just say this. Donald Trump is not going to endorse anybody he thinks is a sure loser. It would be very bad for his brand. He doesn't like to lose, and he doesn't like to be associated with loser. And I don't think that a lot of these people out there, Garrett Soldano and Ryan Kelly and others who may talk the talk, and for that matter, walk the walk in terms of issues that Trump cares about, and that wing of the Trump Republican Party cares about, the bottom line is they are not likely to be able to compete in this name ID game that Kyle alluded to, which can only be purchased, really, when you get right down to it. I mean, if Trump is going to pick somebody other than a Perry Johnson to endorse, he better hope and believe that somebody like Ryan Kelly or Soldano will all of a sudden start getting a lot of money from Trump supporters and the Trump wing of the party. Now, those people are not generally known as big givers. They give in small amounts. There may be a lot of them. But you're right, going back to what, Samantha, you said at the beginning of your statement, this is all about the primary, okay? That's all we're talking about. And I think you're absolutely right that whoever gets a Republican nomination with a Trump endorsement, if that is what happens, they have got to be very careful between then and November not to become so inextricably bound up with Donald Trump in the public mind, or else it not only is going to not be able to win over moderate, centrist, independent ticket splitter voters, it's probably going to drive them away. It is going to drive them into the arms of Gretchen Whitmer. Maybe if they're so turned off by the whole thing, they just sit it out and they don't vote, but they won't be voting for the Republican nominee, and that's going to help Gretchen Whitmer. So yes, it's a double-edged sword. Whoever wins the Republican nomination with Trump's endorsement, they have got to be very careful. They've got to run a Glenn Youngkin, Virginia governor kind of campaign that we saw last fall, where Youngkin basically kept Trump happy, but he didn't embrace him. He held him at arm's length, and he was able to beat a former governor, Terry McAuliffe, in an open seat race. Yep. Of course, you got to remember one thing, and this is something, you know, you didn't have in 1982 or in 2010 or for that matter, 1920. We have an incumbent governor running in this election. Those 3 years I mentioned all were open seat races. So it's a totally new ballgame. This is unprecedented.
Yep. Well, we appreciate the analysis. Bill Ballinger from the Ballinger Report, thanks for coming in and giving your take on this expanded Republican field.
My pleasure, Kyle, always.
Joining us now on the podcast is Representative Tyrone Carter. He's a Democrat from Detroit. Thanks for being on the podcast.
Well, thank you for having me, Kyle. Appreciate it.
Really wanted to get your perspective. Former law enforcement, and just kind of just very quickly, tell our listeners a little bit about your experience in law enforcement prior to being an elected state representative.
Well, prior to being elected, I retired from the Sheriff's Department, Wayne County Sheriff's Department, the state's largest sheriff's department, And I'd worked there for 25 years. I'd worked in pretty much every aspect of the department, whether it's courts, roads, jails, the youth homes, just anything that the sheriff's department has done, absent the Marine team and probably the motorcycles, I did that. After retirement, I worked at Wayne County Community College as the assistant chief slash captain. I want to say five campuses. So we were able to upgrade some things there and bring them into compliance with some other issues that, you know, they had no idea. But with my background and expertise, I've retired. I also been to the FBI Academy. I've taught at the Police Academy. So a pretty well-rounded law enforcement career, if you will.
So obviously you've been watching with interest the recent story in Grand Rapids where we had a man shot by a police officer while resisting a detainment. I wanted to get your thoughts on what you saw and maybe what we should all keep in mind as we're watching that video.
The first thing I think people need to keep in mind is the tragedy. You had a loss of life, and the goal of law enforcement is to preserve life. So you had the loss of life, but you also had the officer take a life. And we need to address that through PTSD, through some counseling, and let the investigation take its course. Now, what we can do in viewing the video is we have the benefit of time, and we can say woulda, coulda, shoulda, as opposed to acting in the moment. As a veteran officer, I would, once I get the guy's information and ID, it's a misdemeanor. He can run all day. I'm towing his car. I'm impounding it. We've got to figure this out sooner than later, because as a taxpayer, we're tired of paying for lawsuits because of what people perceive or are accused of and found guilty of officer misconduct and or lawsuits. So the sooner we become more proactive, if it's a training issue, it's if a cultural bias issue, we've got to be honest about these issues and address them immediately. You know, we had the state police just do somebody did a survey, research, whatever it is, and found out disproportionately African-American men are pulled over more than anybody else. We've got to talk about these things in real time and be honest about.
So as far as you're concerned, then, since this was a misdemeanor, this was a gentleman who had plates that were not registered to the car that he was driving. If he wants to run away, basically just let him go. I mean, the juice isn't worth the squeeze on this one.
Absolutely not. And I've got the vehicle. I'm going to impound that vehicle. Somebody's going to come claim that vehicle. And then we can start it from there. A lot of times, you know, the adrenaline, the rush. And again, I can't set, you know, Monday morning quarterback what somebody else has done, but what we can review it from a policy and procedure standpoint and say, what could we have done differently? What is teachable in this moment? And if you're a one man car and there's no backup, never put yourself in a situation where, you know, you may cause yourself harm. He can run all day in my mind. I've got the car, tow truck's coming. We'll take care of this.
What would you say is the major difference between this very unfortunate tragedy and the tragedies that really empowered the Black Lives Matter movement in 2020?
Well, I think there's glaring differences. When you look at the Black Lives Matter movement, it was based on the George Floyd incident that, I mean, just clearly demonstrated an officer's just total disregard for that person's life. And looking at people who were watching it, in a sense of, yeah, what are you going to do? What are you going to do to stop me? And then you had the other four officers who were training officers whose careers were based on their training superior, which happened to be Derek Chauvin. So those things energize young people, but everyday stops happen. And what can we do? Again, are we going to be honest about the disproportionate of unarmed Black males being shot? As opposed to, I mean, somebody pointed out to me the other day, trying to think of what state it was, but there was a white woman in a Hummer that tore up seven police cars, sent eight officers to the hospital. Not once was a gun drawn. So we've got to do better as a society and just be honest about, you know, what our intent is when we're doing police work.
Representative, you are on the House Michigan State Police Appropriations Subcommittee, where they just kicked out a bill this past week and spent a considerable amount of money. For the first time ever, I saw a budget from the state police, $1 billion. Usually these budgets are about $600 million. This is $1 billion to try and recruit, retain police officers. But you were a pass on that. Here we're putting a lot more money into trying to bring in more law enforcement, and you were hesitant to voting and didn't vote yes. Tell our listeners why.
Well, we had just received the budget 24 hours before that. And there's no way I'm going to vote on a budget, you know, that large on an issue that critical in all these communities with not much time to digest what we're talking about. You talked about $1 billion and you want me to say yes the morning that I receive it. I'm looking at it in front of me right now. There's some things in here that I just need a lot more discussion. So I wasn't a no, I was a pass, because this calls for, you know, more discussion and some research.
I know that the Senate had a police improvement package that is now sitting in the Senate Judiciary Committee. And, you know, there's been a bunch of different legislation, whether it's talking about de-escalation, training, mental health services for law enforcement officers, anything within that realm of improvement. And a lot of times I've noticed is that when, you know, members of the law enforcement groups come forward, they say, you know, this could be nice and it could be very helpful, but we simply just don't have enough money. Just does not seem feasible at all. Do you think it's as simple as that why this legislation isn't passing, or is there a bigger story here?
I would hope that money's not the reason that we do something. And right now we have more money than we've ever had to address some of these issues, whether it's infrastructure, leasing. So I just look at it from a realistic standpoint. What are our priorities as a state, as a small community, when it comes to policing? And you can pay for it one of two ways. You can pay for it being proactive through training when you see an issue, just like we just saw in Grand Rapids. Or you can pay for it on the back end, like they did in Inkster with the $3 million lawsuit. But we cannot continue to just give money to these agencies without any accountability. And I think that's the thing that troubles me more than anything, that, you know, we keep putting money in places or proposing money. When I propose something as simple as a officer misconduct registry that they send to NCOLS so that an officer can't just leave a department under a cloud of suspicion, which happened in Detroit, and he went to Inkster, and go and cost the taxpayers money. There's registries for everybody else. There's registries for bad lawyers. You can look up, you know, how come we can't look up when a police officer has been found guilty of misconduct that may not be criminal, but was a terminatable offense and they quit before they left there? So I'm about public safety. People want safe communities, but we also want accountability. And for us to always look back and say training, what about some psychological evaluations for officers that have been through stuff? There's times that we can sit down and have these conversations, but my Republican counterparts come out with these bills and just want to eat them. And let's be honest and clear. Policing is a lot different in urban areas than it is in suburban areas.
And how so? Tell us kind of the difference, because you've been on both ends of that. You've been in the urban and the suburban.
Well, in an urban area, you have people that come from all around the state and other places to work in that area. So their relationship with that community sometimes doesn't exist. And a lot of biases and preconceived notions come with that until they do it. In most small towns, and I have E-Course in River Rouge, most of the chief of E-Course went to E-Course High School. River Rouge, they're from that area. So they have this connectability, good, bad, or indifferent. And that probably happens in almost every small department. But when you have large departments, I can't say Pontiac because they don't have a department anymore. When you have, say, a Detroit, a Flint, a Saginaw, a Muskegon, a Benton Harbor, you know, when you have to recruit and you bring in outside officers that have no connection to, sometimes that creates unnecessary problems. a lot more times than not than you see in small communities where, you know, pretty everybody knows everybody.
One more thing here before we let you go, then. If you were able to craft a Michigan State Police budget and you're looking at a situation where there are more openings for police officers than police officers on the streets in Michigan, what are you doing to try and change that around?
First, we have to look at why this went from a career to a job. And the reason that has happened, you know, you heard that defund the police, that, you know, some Democrats said, and the Republicans jumped all over it and said, you know, the environment. No, I'm never about defunding the police. I'm more about making it a career again. And if I were to do a couple of things in this budget, I would increase the multiplier for smaller departments. And people understand that when it comes to retirement, that's number one. Number two, healthcare. A lot of departments, once you retire, you don't have healthcare. I'll use Detroit as an example. You can serve 25, 30, 40 years. And if you're not ready for Medicare, when you leave there, even if you were injured on the job, you don't have any health care. That's the other thing. Paid time off. There are a lot of that have been chipped away in contract negotiations that we have the opportunity. I mean, we're talking about putting 57,500,000 in recruiting officers to come from other states. What happens to get them here and they say, look at these benefits packages and say, wait a minute, I can do better somewhere else. Let's look at why we're losing officers to other professions first. And let's have those conversations. And I know, because I'm still really connected with quite a few officers that I've mentored, and they say that people are leaving because the benefits. You know, we used to get day one benefits for you and your family. Now you have to pay for those things. If we look at a way to, again, this used to be a career. You had relatives, sons, daughters, and grandkids doing this. Now, most of the people on the job tell their kids to go someplace else. And it's partly because of the benefits. I mean, the environment's changed, but there are some things that we can do institutionally that will make people say, well, this is a viable option to be police again.
Tyrone Carter, state representative, a Democrat out of Detroit. Appreciate you being on the podcast and sharing your thoughts on this.
I appreciate the opportunity. And I think we need to have more conversations, not just with the media, but across the aisle, because I am pro-police. And if they had sat down for 15 minutes, we probably could have came up with a better budget.
Very good. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of the MERS Monday podcast. Appreciate Tyrone Carter, state representative, coming on, Bill Ballinger, and also Caitlin Buss and Scott Hagerstrom. And Samantha, as we're looking out the second floor window here at MERS World Headquarters, if April showers bring May flowers, what does April snow bring?
Oh, I have no idea, but it just makes me sleepy. I'm going to need another cup of coffee. I'm tired. And I'm ready for summer. I'm ready to, I feel so embarrassed because I know we had an episode of the podcast where I was talking about the weather's getting nicer. Let's get outside and get the enthusiasm up. And now it's just been kind of a gloomy spring.
Well, you know what though? I don't know if you've looked ahead here, but did you see the forecast for Saturday and Sunday?
70 degree days.
74 degrees.
I'm going to go to the beach.
But don't go into the water because you'll probably still come out as a popsicle.
No, I'm just going to hang out in the sand, maybe play some volleyball.
All right, there you go. Thank you to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Mark Bayshore for putting it together and making us sound halfway decent. And, John Roering for being the brains behind the operation. Until next week, I'm Kyle Malin. Take care.